welcome to the UCB Theater podcast number, oh god, I think it's 36 or 37.
Fuck, I don't know.
I really got to look it up before I come in here.
Why have you become concerned with the number of these episodes?
Because it's good to keep track of it, you know? What happens when we get to 100? We have to have a cake.
Okay. I guess that's right. It's a new thing for the past four episodes where you're
yeah, really... well, the date, because the date is kind of nebulous. We never get them out in a consistent time.
So you can't count weeks.
So we can't count weeks, so we just say numbers.
Okay, I guess it represents accomplishment.
Exactly.
Like, the higher we get this. We're going for volume.
Yeah, that's all we're going for.
Okay, I can appreciate that. That answered my question.
Sitting next to me is Will Hines.
Oh, and sitting next to me is John Frusciante. Hello, John.
Hello, Will. How are you?
I'm all right.
And sitting next to both of us is Anthony Atamanik.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, Anthony.
Is there going to be cake today or no?
No,
sorry. You'll have to come back in how many, like 40? No, sorry.
We don't know how many. That's to John's frustration.
Like 70 weeks.
Yeah,
60 some odd weeks.
You've also not known the last four times what episode it is.
No,
you
can't
actually number it.
You would think that I would write it down before I came in here, knowing as part of my prep work that I'm going to have to say it. But.
Today's episode is being recorded in the electrical closet. UCB Training Center, New York. This is true.
Yep.
We did the Gethard one in here, and
I wasn't there.
You weren't here that week, and it was me and Shannon and Gethard. And one thing we have to look forward to that I'm just now remembering is these pipes overhead will at some point just like dominate the sound.
Oh,
like it'll just sound like somebody's taking a piss, which it maybe will be,
right?
Or just like water running through the pipes or hissing. That's gonna happen.
That's fine. That's
so. Let's look forward to that.
Yeah.
It's just like the theater. So
yeah,
no
yeah,
real
yeah.
difference from the...
It's just grungy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty true.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in here getting high.
Yeah, so this,
oh,
is,
okay.
this is familiar ground.
Yeah, this is a familiar place.
Perfect. It's the perfect room for... It's the only perfect room for that.
It feels like we're at war. No, like we're prisoners of war in like a Nazi camp, and we've like sequestered... We've secured some little area to make plans.
Yes.
It's like we've tunneled into this room to like...
Or we're on Caprica... Post the Cylon attack,
yeah,
and we're hiding out in some like Starbucks apartment.
Yeah, Cylon occupied Caprica.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Watching season two.
Ooh, really?
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Still good at that point.
I think I stopped maybe a couple of episodes. No, I don't think I started season two. I think I watched season one and then.
Then
stopped.
All is good. It's like you'll not see it tarnish into the weirdness.
Oh, you know what I did?
That's what I'm afraid of.
It's such a brilliant series for a while.
I can't believe
you haven't seen it yet. I feel like it's right up your alley.
I know, but I missed it when it came out the first year and a half, and then I was like, "Fuck it, I'm
too
not
much time
bother.
To invest.
It's
it.
Too
yeah,
much time.
That happens.
I figured eventually it would come out on Netflix, which it did.
Right.
Yeah. I haven't seen Friday Night Lights yet, even though that is unanimously regarded.
Yeah, that's the other one to watch. Yeah.
I can't.
I haven't watched that either. Yeah, I just started Breaking Bad because AMC is rerunning them all from the beginning in order.
My brother berated me pretty incessantly for a long time to watch, and he was right. That
it's the best show on
amazing.
Television.
Yeah.
The best show on television.
The storytelling in that show is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So good.
Well, what I did with Galactica was I watched the third part of the last. I watched the very last episode first.
Of the series.
Yep. Just so that I could just...
That is
strange. Because everyone had said, like, it's really disappointing. And I was like, you know what? I am just going to kill it now. So that way I can just really enjoy it and not be like, oh, what a disappointment.
Yeah,
so I already had my disappointment where Adama and what's-her-name, like, fly off in their little vehicle.
Yeah, yeah. It's so
and wave
cheesy.
Goodbye.
Uh-huh. It's really weird.
The last episode is... The narrative of like an 8-year-old playing with action figures.
Yeah, just tying everything up. And,
yeah,
marrying everybody. Sort
and
of.
You've spoiled it for me and everybody else listening to the podcast who hasn't.
Nothing is ruined.
Nothing
is ruined. By the time you even know enough of that to be ruining, you'll be divested.
Yes.
But the part you're watching now is great. The for a while, Battlestar is an amazing show.
It turns out Adama has a Guado in his.
Yeah,
it.
He's
oh,
got a
really?
Guado.
Yeah.
That,
why is everybody hating on it?
That he's sounds... a hilarious, wisecracking
yeah,
Guado.
Yeah.
He's a really lighthearted sort of like voice of reason.
Yeah, he's done. Don Rickles' voices.
Yep.
Just insulting Starbucks for an hour, taking pot shots at her.
He's like, oh, Don Ching Ching, Boomer. How you doing, Boomer? I can't believe you're a pilot with those eyes.
Right. God, it's it. And that's the good part of those episodes.
So Anthony Atamanik is on Death by Ruru currently at the theater.
Yeah.
Celebrated member of said team.
That's right.
You teach here at the training center.
That is true.
And you've been on a host of other Harold teams throughout your tenure here at the UCB. So why don't you start the way we always start. Tell us how you found improv in the UCB.
Well, I started... I grew up in a family where my parents were both artists. My dad was a drummer and my mom was a dancer, so they sort of always you know, encouraged, I guess, for me to do theater when I was young. So I don't know if I had a choice. So I guess in high school was when I first actually did improv, but like short, like did short form.
Okay.
So
we used to do part of the country is this?
This was in Boston, Massachusetts. I grew up in Boston, but I in high school, I went to the North Shore to a town called Hamilton Wenham, Massachusetts. I went to their regional high school.
Okay.
And long and the short, we would do these things called FNFs, Friday Night Festivals. And they were like, we had a big theater in the high school, but what we would do is do the show on, like, on the stage, like have seating on the stage, right, and then have a, like, a tiny stage on the stage. Yeah. Okay. So a stage on the stage.
Okay.
So we'd do, like, you know, Hitchhiker and ABC and all that stuff. And so that's what I thought it was for a long time. I went into college at Emerson College, also in Boston.
Okay.
Entertainment, acting oriented.
Yes, yeah. Very. And, you know, lots of comedians have come out of Emerson and all that. And I did a group called the Swollen Monkey Showcase.
Very nice.
Which was Dave Cross and I forget who else. They were in a group called This Is Pathetic. And there were two members that were really irritating and agitating people. Uh-huh. And they kicked them out of Pathetic. And they started my comedy group.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you're a splinter group.
We were a splinter group. So I did that, and that's where I first did the Herald, actually, was in college. But we did it where it was three scenes and then a built-in group game. So the first one was Where's Charlie?
Oh, so you'd choose the group game.
Yes.
Okay.
And then three more second beats or three more of the set, but we didn't know that at the time. And then we did the ad game. So we did the ad game and that, and then so then I graduated from there, moved to LA, wrote for the Muppets for a while, for their online division, and moved back to New York after a massive sort of crash and burn.
Yeah, which
in my
you
life.
Talk about extensively in your
in my story and pissing
my pants
on
Vine. Yeah,
this is my one man spectacular one-man show.
It was great.
2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yep.
Was it that long ago?
Yep. Haven't produced anything since.
No.
Wow.
So then I came here and I started working with, it was funny, I lived on Ocean Parkway out in Brooklyn on someone's sofa, and I looked up in the back of The Voice, or I forget what paper it was, and there was UCB.
Yeah.
And Gotham City Improv
right.
were the two places.
Probably New York Press. I feel like I remember.
Yeah, it was
this
New
layout.
York Press. Yeah. And so the price of Gotham City Improv was, I think, $30 less
right.
for an 8-week class. Yeah. And so I, being the.
And at that time, they were like right next to each other.
They yeah,
like
they were
ones
one
on
was
23rd
around,
street
yeah, around
and
the corner.
We were 22nd
yeah.
Street.
And yeah. so I went to Gotham City Improv first because it was like, oh, it's $30 cheaper.
Right.
So I went there. There's a lot of expat UCBers there, like Dave Stork and Jeff LaGreca and Tom Blake, who were all early Herald team members.
Right.
And there we did short form in the beginning, then learned long form. This is boring as shit.
No,
this is right in the wheelhouse.
All
right.
Yeah,
that's how we've gotten to episode number 30, whatever.
30 something. I hope it's 37 because I'm obsessed with that number. But
I hope so. For your sake.
Yeah, but so then I was there for a little while, and I'd gotten the main company really quickly, like their staging company.
Okay.
And Ptolemy would do shows.
I remember that.
Ago.
Yeah, there were some overlap people.
Yeah,
who
Jeff Richmond,
did both.
Tina Fey's husband, directed the main company for the first, like, very little bit that I was in it.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? How much are you getting on stage? How often are you doing?
We were doing every Friday night. We were doing a show for a sold out 40 person house on the second floor above Monster Sushi.
Yes,
I remember that.
That's right.
Yeah. And so there was a guy who's passed away, whose name was Jonathan Appel, who was a director.
Yeah,
and he passed away this summer.
Yeah.
And he was from Canada, sort of a spindly...
He did a great Alec Guinness voice.
Yeah, he did.
He used to break that out in the improv jams, I remember.
Yeah, and that's how I went to UCB. First show I saw at UCB, well, I saw a jam, and I saw him in it, which was interesting. But then I saw Third Degree. Which,
I remember you
Curtis
coming
around
and John's
show, yeah.
And I would go, and I...
Curtis and Pete Bosniak, actually.
Oh,
Curtis and John weren't friends
right,
yet,
yes.
Or they were becoming.
They
friends
were just playing
at
together.
That time. Yeah.
And Ptolemy, the one I saw, Ptolemy was a judge, and he had a marker, and he the entire time he had the marker cap off, and he was, you know, playing that he was incidentally just drawing on his face.
Yeah.
And
this was an improvised courtroom show
yeah.
where like people would sort of have characters they'd picked before, but the court case itself was improvised.
Yes.
And testimony would cut away to scenes.
Yes. It was like, a great show.
It ran forever. Yeah. It was like over 2 years that ran. And the desks that are on the stage
are known as the third degree tables.
They were made for the third degree, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
Pete Bosniak made the original ones, so I think they've been like fossilized and replaced and repaired.
There's so many new nails and joints and things.
But this is that show, Friday at 8 o'clock. It ran for like forever.
And so I saw that. It's funny. I saw Kirsten John. I remember being like, ooh, those guys, you know. They're really great. And so Jonathan would direct these improvised films for his doctorate. He would get like these amazing people. So he was getting Adam McKay.
He would just ask. He was this guy. Yeah. He just had the guts to ask. And he would just and video, I think, was still enough of a novelty. Because this is like, what, 2001 or something?
Yeah, this is 2001.
Yeah. So like, just, it was like, oh, you can get a video happening? You're a magician.
Yeah. And he was shooting on HD. I mean, he was shooting like high def.
Right.
Like and so that's where I met Mal Walsh there. I met Ian Roberts was doing that the one that we did, this Brother Joe one, and Adam McKay. I had no, you know, I didn't know who anybody was in there. And then I think it was Walsh who said to me, you should come over to the UCB and check it out. Like, just, you know.
Yeah. He pushed
you casually. Class. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I went and signed up for classes and, like, just, you know, said, okay, I'll just restart and take classes. And that's when you waited in line at the theater. And
with
I remember waiting in line and being like, because I'm a intense ball of fear. Like, that's all I really am, is just filled with fear. And all of my behavior
it's
is
all
simply
fear-based.
It's all my affability, everything is a protection from anyone ever cracking the true, you know, the true sham that is me. And so I remember waiting in that line and everyone was joking and and I was like, oh God, fuck, I'm fucked. Like, no, I'm gonna be such a I shouldn't have done this. Like, everyone's funnier and all that. And Sylvia Ozels was in my level one with Ari Vukitis.
Very nice.
And Sylvia and I had a train ride back to Astoria where I think I, like, really annoyed her because I was talking about politics. And she was, and literally the conversation got to the point where I got up. We, like, at one point, she's like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. And I was like, all right.
Sylvia, who's, like, such an accommodating person.
Right. Yeah, I pushed Sylvia to the brink of being, like, shut I thought she hated me for a long time, and then I level two with Anthony King, and I don't know, and then I went through 3 and 3B at the time,
okay,
and I did a mini 4 with Walsh,
okay,
and then I did Instant Cinema,
okay,
and that was where I first met Neil, Curtis, and John.
I remember that was a great class. That was the first movie class that had happened in a while. I think Brian Husky and Dynamo taught it.
Yeah, and
Curtis and John. Okay, yeah. So the old feature crew.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you were in there, and Neil and Joe.
Yes.
Gambling, Curtis.
Yep.
Who else was in there? A ton of people in there.
Zach Woods. Jeez.
Kirk D'Amato was in there.
Yeah, wait. Kate, well, Sylvia was in it too, right?
Sylvia, yeah. Kate Emsweller, was that her name?
I don't know.
Yes, Kate Emsweller. I can't.
Well, I feel like I don't remember all the names. I remember the class.
Weird remembering.
One and the one after were really good, but that one was like everybody was in it. I remember going to all the student shows. They were all super hilarious.
And we had a run for almost 2 years. We had a run.
Yeah.
Instant Cinema had a run.
I think that's where I met you. I feel like that. I think I had met you like handshake hello at the old theater around third degree time. But
yes.
It was Instant Cinema that you sort of like arrived for whatever it's worth, like in the scene, or I don't know, maybe.
All I remember is Dinah being like, I didn't know how to figure Dinah. Like, she scared me.
Of course.
And was, you know, true. Like, it was very honest.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting at the bar with her at McManus after like our second Instant Cinema class show. And we were just sitting and it was like silent and whatever. And she just, I forget what, she said something like, you know, I guess, you know, something that was sort of like, you're still a pain in the ass, but you're okay.
Right.
And I was like, ooh, she's now my
gushing
friend.
Yeah.
Which is like a gushing compliment. and it was, we had a thing where we watched movies. Uh-huh. I wish that whenever they do the movie class here, I wish the students would do more getting together and watch the movies together, because we would get together at Curtis and John's apartment on Second Avenue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I used to do this cable access show called Captain Conspiracy.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about this. Yeah.
This was before I was at the theater. And so we're sitting there and they're looking up the movies, and on their DVR is Captain Conspiracy. And I'm like, that's me. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, that's my cable access show. So they had me on their DVR before I...
Nice.
Was everybody calling you Clams Casino at this time? Was that happening?
No. Well, the awful nicknames are... Ari would call me Showtime.
Why?
He would call me Showtime because I was, like, always ready to perform and, like, hammy. Oh, I was wicked hammy. Seth Morris broke me of my hamminess.
How so?
We had a practice group. I forget the name of it. Oh, Cobra Kai. It was the name of it. It was Cobra Kai.
Right.
It was with a bunch. I can't remember the people in it. And I remember we did a rehearsal. I think it was the last one Seth did with us, where I did this scene. It was like in a bell tower or something. And he was like, you're not being like, you're just being so hammy and so jokey. And he's like, you're funny. He's like, but you need to play like straight and real.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me do the scene. It felt like an hour. It was probably 25 minutes of just doing the scene over and over again until he felt I was being real in the class. He probably does. I mean, I remember that.
Right.
And I remember that moment being like, oh, I have to not just be a fucking moron.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, the thing I can't stand now when I watch, like when people are like, yuppie, yuppie, you know,
yeah.
It was you know, me.
Yeah.
I could look in the mirror and see it.
And you remember it because it was a huge moment in your development.
I do remember it. And so, yeah, so then we did that. Then I got on a Herald team. I auditioned.
Trillion.
Got on the ever-amazing Trillion. we somehow were around for a year.
Yeah.
And that was Sue Galloway, and Neil was on it for a little bit after he left Filth.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was Jen Hammaker.
Right.
Betsy Todd.
Eric Bernat.
Ryan Rogers. Yeah, Ryan Rogers.
Who was that one guy? Wasn't Gibberman on the team for a while?
Dan Gilberman?
Yeah.
Yes, he was great.
Yeah, he went and got his PhD in San Francisco or something.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like this super slow,
slow
cadence, like super funny.
Yeah, like, so smart.
Yeah.
You know? Uh-huh. And Dan was the one you were like, wow, I wish I could have the patience and smarts.
I'm
Dan
an idiot
had.
When
okay.
I talk to this guy.
So yeah.
That's what I remember feeling like.
Yep, yep. And then that got dissolved, and we went on a wonderful team called Grenade versus Washington.
Yes. And legendary Grenade.
Legendary team. Just absolutely.
One of the worst names. I think, wasn't it?
Do you want to know who suggested it?
Who?
Me.
I
I'm
feel
the
like...
worst namer. I don't ever ask me to name shit.
I feel like I remember somebody hearing, oh, what's that? What's the new team? It's like Grenade versus Washing Machine. So I was like, that's going to be a bad team. Like, just based on the name.
Well,
I
you
feel
know
like...
what it was, too, is I got an email from a cop. I worked in Times Square, and the cops were friends of mine, and this one guy, Donnie, would email me. He forwarded some email that just said Grenade versus Washing Machine in the subject heading.
Yeah.
I didn't know that it was a... who's the guy in Margaritaville?
Jimmy Buffett?
It's a Jimmy Buffett line.
I didn't know that until
song.
This moment.
I didn't know that either.
And I'm a casual Jimmy Buffett fan.
Oh, God.
A little bit. Changes in Attitudes. It's a great album. Beyond that, it's mostly garbage, but that's a good album.
I remember watching some movie of a Jimmy Buffett concert from like the early 80s, and it was like at some resort, and there were like people in inner tubes and like little short shorts.
I've seen that. It is
just
the worst.
Looked like a cesspool of like syphilis and venereal.
It looks like everything that every stereotypical 80s thing, every like awful, yuppie, like coke addled,
DeLoreans in the background
person. Yeah. And when he does Madison
All Time Machines.
Yeah. Yeah. When he does Madison Square Garden and all those fucking gross, sloppy parrot heads are walking around.
Parrot heads.
I'm like, oh, that is gross. But I do love that album.
Well, and so
I had no idea Grenade vs. Wash Machine is a Jimmy Buffett.
I had no idea that.
Yeah, and so
to you it was just a cop thing.
And I also just literally everyone was like submit names.
Yeah.
And so I just was like, well, I guess this will be mine.
Right.
You know, because I was never really into
you didn't
the
give
naming
a shit,
pride.
Right, right.
I didn't give a shit. So that was like a super team of like all these great people.
Right, right.
Charlie Sanders, Will McLaughlin,
Neil,
Sue right, yeah.
Galloway, Dave Martin, Eli Newell.
Right. Allison Becker was on there too.
Yeah,
right?
Becker was, I mean, it was like a crazy, supposedly on paper, should be a good team.
Still sounds like a good team.
Yeah. But what happened? I mean, what was it like? Did you feel at a certain point like, oh, something is off here? Or something is
stilted,
right here?
Weird rehearsals. And
it
like,
wasn't that. I mean, you guys were okay.
Like, no. We had fun, but it was like we were like weird with like there was like weird rehearsals. I just remember Sanders and I used to like do a lot of like we would do batshit scenes because we didn't really care. I think
it was like if a team can be an entity, like Grenade vs. Wash Machine was like somebody who was just bottoming out, like in their life, like good people who were just like this. We don't give a shit. We're not connected. We're showing up like with our tie loosened and like our shoes don't match.
I remember Gethard he'll tell you this. Like he was coaching us, and one time we showed up to some rehearsal studio on 8th and like 52nd or something, and like Dave showed up. I was there. There's like three people there.
Yeah.
Nobody's called and said they're not coming. Nobody's emailed. And Gethard's like, what the fuck is up with you people? Like, it's like, and he's like, I guess we'll have a rehearsal. We're like, fuck it. Let's just go. And it was like, that was like the death. That was the death knell.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to, Doug Moe left for Mother from Creep.
Okay.
And I joined Creep to replace Doug Moe.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, I'm getting, this is awful. Yeah. I can't replace Doug. You know, I think in my head I was like, they're such a great team.
You felt you weren't good enough for that situation?
I felt I wasn't good enough, and I felt like I was filling big shoes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, and so then I joined, and I was Billy Merritt coached that team.
That was an Owen Burke assembled team, I believe. I think that might have been Owen's last. This could be wrong, what I'm saying right now, but I feel like that was Owen's last team before Anthony took over as artistic director. I feel like Owen did one of these like late night, like when the president like pardons 100 people before he leaves.
That's how Ruru got a weekend slot.
Like right before Owen left, he like assembled like four teams or something. You know what? I could be completely wrong.
And John, I might be wrong about it, but I think that Owen had something to do with like getting us in under the wire.
Yeah, I think Creep
wasn't
was
in it yet, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Creep was a great team. Super team.
Creep was the best.
Before so and fun. While you were on it.
Yeah, it was great before. It was great. And, I mean, that was Birch, Harms, and Ryan Carles. And, I mean, that was Sylvia.
Sylvia,
yeah.
So, yeah. The whole time. What do you mean, maybe?
I don't know. My brain. I'm trying.
Jeff Hiller, Eliza.
I have good recall right now.
Who was Creep when you were on? It was you, Birch, Jeff Hiller, Sylvia, Eliza, Eric Bernat.
Eric Bernat, yep.
Every time. Ryan Carles.
Yes.
Who are we missing?
I'm trying to... My brain.
I mean, Angelique ended up on it.
Oh, Angelique. Yeah, Angelique.
But she was added, I think.
No, I was... She was on when I joined.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that was so much fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We just did... I loved it because we were... abstract, and they do music. We do musical stuff, and we do.
Somebody's phone is going.
We do all sorts of weird, sort of threaded heralds.
You guys are really theatrical and character-y, very theatrical, and like,
and we used to have dinners, everyone liked each other and actually spent time with each other.
Yeah.
You know, and so we would have a Creep dinner where we would all then, I don't know if I should reveal, but we'd do this thing about like, we'd share something we'd never shared with anybody in the circle.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
And do stuff. And Ryan did that theater warm up of Shay Shay Kool-Aid.
Oh, yeah.
So that was our sort of thing we ended up doing just as our warm up.
Yeah.
I just remember those just memories that were really wonderful, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was great.
From Creep, you...
Was Cordero on Creep? Was Eugene?
Eugene. Oh, Eugene and I had every... Oh, Jesus.
I knew we're forgetting.
I hope...
Every time I try to list somebody on a team,
yeah,
I leave somebody out. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I hear about it. Last time I tried to list Creep, I left Birch out.
Just remember I used a lot of pot and alcohol in my life. And, you know, that's... Eugene and I were... we always talk about when we see each other of just... We would do all the sit-out, set two chairs down and just sit down and be two guys on a bench, two guys in front of a store, two guys in front of anything.
Me and Dave Lombard used to do that on Petrol all the time.
Yeah.
Every single scene we did was like two blue-collar guys just sitting down having a conversation.
And it was great.
Yeah. Magazine's of creeped amazing. At a lot of QVC scenes, a lot of like Home Shopping Network scenes.
That was
scenes.
Jeff Hiller.
Yeah, Hiller. I feel like I also saw a lot of campfire scenes where yes. Carl's would be like walking up to a campfire yes. and like yeah. dispensing wisdom to whoever else. Yes. I saw
also,
that a lot.
Also, lots of portals opening. Lots of sci-fi portals.
Yeah. lots of old men creeping into like the back room of a store and finding yeah. something weird. That would yep. be a creep thing.
That's
musical yeah. theater references and dancing. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Lots of dancing.
It was way more dancing than average Harold show.
Yeah.
And Creep's first beats would be like 35 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I remember like it would be like three mono scenes, a group game, then get blacked out like in the middle of the second beats.
Yeah.
And with the audience going nuts.
Right.
Like exploding.
Yeah. It was great. We and that went for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And so okay. from Creep yeah, you sorry, went yeah. to, that's okay.
Yeah.
What was after Creep?
Oh, and then I was on Creep and I started playing with Ruru.
Okay.
So I become, you know, I'd sort of stayed friends with Curtis and John and Neil and, you know, Monkey Dick Folk and the
right.
whole nine. And,
right.
And they would invite me to play, you know, a lot of times MC Chris and Jackie and I would play,
mm-hmm.
Jackie Clark.
Right.
And so.
Before you and Jackie were members.
Before Jackie and I were members. And so that, you know, happened for about 4 months, I think. And it just was a fun fit. And I always approach, as I approach most things, like I'm just happy to be able to show up and do this. I don't have any expectations because anytime I ever have expectations, that's like the worst
oh, yeah.
possible right. thing that can happen
because yep.
there's no good outcome.
Yeah.
And so I just approach it that way. And then they came to Harold Night. Curtis and John came to Harold Night and were like, do you want to join Ruru? And I was in the hallway, and I was like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then I went, and we did the Creep show, and then after the show ended, I was like, I'm leaving the team. But it was actually worked perfectly because Jeff Hiller had left Creep to do a show. Mm-hmm. He had toured, and then we had put someone else on, which I think was...
See, I think that was Angeliki.
Was that Angeliki?
I think Angeliki like... got added while
I thought
you
that was
on.
Neuringer. But Neuringer, no, I think, replaced no, Eliza. Eliza.
Yeah.
But so when I Hiller happened to be in the hallway, or I forget who, it was Anthony King or whatever.
Hiller was off the team somehow.
Yes,
and so
and
he
I
needed
said,
a place to go.
And I said, why don't – I'm going to leave. Just put Hiller back on Creep. And
yeah.
then it everything stays sort of intact.
Yeah.
So that's how that happened. And then I started playing with the, you know, the most transformative group of people I've ever performed with in my life.
Sure.
And, yeah.
I want to touch on something yeah. that you had mentioned earlier, because Jimmy Buffett. Let's go back to Jimmy Buffett. No, you had mentioned kind of half-jokingly your show and how you haven't produced anything in
right.
2.5 years.
True.
That's what I want to go. That's what I kind of am curious about, because you and I think, have very similar kind of attitudes and points of view. I too consider myself just like a walking ball of fear, except I feel like you. Mask it better in affability than
yeah.
I do. I just people see it coming for me 40 yards away.
Yeah.
But do you really feel like you have not produced anything in the last 2.5 years? Because
no. I mean, I feel like in the sense that when I say I haven't produced anything, like I mean, you remember I did that school spank and then I just sort of never did anything with it because I went on the Pop-Tarts thing.
Right.
Remember, and you and Anthony came and it was like, we'll probably do it. But then I just was like, bye. And
yeah.
left. Like, you know, yeah, I don't think I produce as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely better at it now. Like, I know John and I were working on something, and I'm doing, more stuff.
Right.
And I do, you know, I write my stories for nights, or at least come up with them 5 minutes before the show. and so in that sense, I show up. But I think that the trick being that I observe but can't apply yet, or apply less,
mm-hmm.
is that the theater is an amazing resource that you have to plug yourself into.
Right.
If you are only at the behest of the things you do, the disposable things you do at the theater, it's still amazing
mm-hmm.
to do, but it is sort of like eating white bread. There's not a lot of value ultimately except
mm-hmm.
in exercising your craft. But like I could do an improv show every week for years and it's going to be to a certain degree great and a valuable thing. But if I take the option and do something at the theater that's mine... then or shot and able to bring it other places, that's to me produce like that's making something that's tangible and of me.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. There's a huge difference between, like you said, doing improv every week, which is essentially disposable.
Yes.
Yeah, sometimes an agent comes or somebody comes and is like, oh, you know, I'd like to see you for this thing.
Right.
But there's a huge difference between that and sitting down and disciplining yourself to be able to produce work. Yeah.
And I think I did, I think that the thing, I think the thing is like, I feel like that's, I mean, I'm just, I guess I, you know, my therapist would say that I'm letting my spoiler talk for me, but like, I'm in a much better place than I was even 2 years ago when I did the show. And the show I did 2 years ago, I don't know if I would do Pissing My Pants, that show again. I feel like when I started telling stories, it was more of like, look at the sideshow, look at the car wreck. That was what I was bringing, was like, here, look, I did this with a prostitute, or I smoked heroin, methamphetamine or whatever. But like, that show to me sort of also is painful to do, because it's like, you know, at a certain point, you're like, I've done these things enough times that I don't feel I need to just capitalize on that, you know, that area. And so like Nights of Our Lives, that show has allowed me to expand past the idea that my limitation is just my being fucked up or the fucked up things I did.
Mm-hmm.
That is a governor on me that I don't need to have. A governor being something that used to be in cars that kept them from speeding.
Ah. Thank you. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
A restrictor.
Right.
Yeah.
So, did you have anything?
Well, I want to talk about Ruru.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I want to talk about, you just said it, you said transformative.
Yes.
So talk about, so when you joined Ruru officially, and you already knew those guys and played with them a lot.
Yes.
So it wasn't like it was, you know, it wasn't like a huge surprise change. But I think it did signify something important in your development, like as a player.
Yeah.
Like you were always talented, and very early on you were connected to like a lot of the funniest people in the theater. But for whatever reason, timing, opportunity, you spent a lot of time on teams that weren't really that great, things that didn't come together. But now Ruru, it's like weekend team.
Yeah.
Established reputation, really charismatic people, yourself included, coming off of Creep, which was like a great Herald team.
And them coming off of Monkey Dick, which you were a part of, which was an amazing team that I watched. And
you were like Monkey Dick's biggest fan.
And my mother used to come see my shows from Boston, and she saw a Trillion show where Monkey Dick closed. And afterwards she goes, I go, Mom, how was the show? She goes, yeah, your show was okay. Why aren't you on that team? And I was like, thanks.
Yeah.
I remember my heart just being like, oh, all right. Thanks, Mom.
But she was right. You were meant to be on that team, and you were with all those people. So what was it like? Like, what was different about playing with Ruru, or I don't know. Talk about what it's like to play with these guys.
What
are the shows like?
I would say that I learned on the fly. Like the beauty of that team was that there's all truth. Like, I mean, this sounds so pretentious, but like there's just no bullshit. Like, you know, Gemberling, like, or, you know, or Gelman or any of them, everyone has their bullshit, but like, there's no bullshit allowed in a way, you know? Mm-hmm. And if someone tries
just moment to moment,
you can't get away with trying to put up a front. And we just discussed that's sort of like, my core thing.
Right, right.
So here I am from my perspective, put in a situation where I have to drop that. Mm-hmm. And so that just forced me to be like, okay, I've got to play at a level that I am capable of communicating on stage and holding my own with them.
Help me articulate this.
Sure.
I don't know if I can do it. So, because like I agree with you. I think that's the main thing about Ruru shows, is like just everybody seems held to a standard, and they will be called out on the spot in front of everybody if they feel like you're posing or force or trying to contrive something.
Yes.
If it doesn't make sense with what you know, in like a hilarious and educational way. But there is, at the same time, tons of like fantastical, huge things that happen in Ruru shows.
Oh, yeah.
Like what you were talking about before, about like the, what'd you call the creature that's in the stomach of Total Recall?
Guado. Oh, the Guado, yeah.
Guado being like Don Rickles in the stomach of
That could
Adama.
Be a Ruru show.
That could be a Ruru show. Like,
yeah.
Easily.
Yeah, yeah.
Adama could enter, or an Adama-like character could be, and then you reveal that. And that would be allowed.
Right. Yes.
And embraced. But that is a form of bullshit and ridiculousness.
Yes.
So how is that tolerant? I mean, I know what you're saying, but
how do you
articulate
that? Although I do think that Curtis in that scene would be like, come on, man. I think there would be a part of Curtis would be like, come on, man. What are you doing?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Really? Yeah. Maybe.
I think that there is a mutual appreciation mentally for sort of a lot of the same things. So there's sort of a core of like everyone sort of appreciating this, maybe the same media, the same sort of story structure, yeah. Hero journey, or whatever you want to call that. And I think there's a love of each other's minds. I'm the like, I guess I'm sort of like Ringo-y in the sense that I'm all about like, it's about the love. But it really was like, I mean, that was like, you were instantly in a love, like a completely loving environment filled with five other people who even if you did that thing of being, there's nothing that isn't done with like care or appreciation for the other person's mind and perspective. And there's a level of commitment and also saying, okay, if this is where we're going, then let's make it the absolute best, absolute thing it can be in that moment on stage. So like the Guado scene would get, I guess, blown out. I mean, you know, yeah, we do like time. We did a one where it was like a RoboCop thing where like I was like a chess playing robot.
Oh yeah, and like right.
And like
I think Neil talked about this.
Neil, and that's the thing. We did a mono scene that time, right? Mm-hmm. That was our mono scenes, but we had to. Neil ended up doing cuts, so we did this mono scene that still was cutting to other things. So everyone just went, okay, that's what we're doing.
Right.
There was no like, oh, now we're not doing a mono scene. There was never any ego. There's no ego. There's no ego construct in that group. Is that a way to describe it?
I know what you're
it?
Saying, and I'm interested enough in Riru that I think I don't totally agree. I know what you're.
I'm not saying there's no ego in the group.
There is, yeah.
I'm saying, but there's no false construct of it,
right?
Which
right,
is
right,
different.
Right. Collectively, there's no judgment. There's no like.
Well, there
you hold
judgment,
each other to a really high standard of being smart. So if you say something that John feels is full of shit, he's going to call you on it.
Yeah.
But then you answer it. Like,
right.
He's going to challenge you that you answer it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no, like, if somebody's challenged, like, all right, well, fuck you then.
No, it's like back that shit up. And, yeah. I think the other thing, like, joining that was, like, you know, we instantly were spending all our time with each other. So then there gets to a point in that group, I mean, in the salad days of that of Ruru, which I would say was when it was that six. I mean, that was sort of, to me, the most amazing.
Right.
Which was Jackie Gelman, Neil, Curtis.
John and you.
Yeah. And it's not like now. It's like that was just its own thing. And I think there was like, these are all pompous words, but like it was sort of transcendent. Like plus we were at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. The antagonism between us and the audience was palpable a lot of times. They were throwing tampons on stage and people were getting drunk. We had a guy filibuster our show for 25 minutes and not let the second half go up because he was angry that he wasn't called to be interviewed.
Well, it was a spot that Friday at 11 was a spot that did not exist.
Right.
Monkey Dick had it and never really could fill it consistently. So when Ruru took it over, it was a spot that wasn't really working yet.
Right.
And then it did work. Ruru found an audience and brought it to that spot and made it like, you know, it was like Ruru was an animal that burrowed into the side of a canyon where there was no plants and like created a home for itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Till it was like a thriving spot.
Yeah.
It was like a, you know, and that was all just Ruru building it.
It was like a Star Trek crew. I mean, it's sort of like when you think of like the crew of Star Trek or like a classic, like you had sort of a classic breakdown of archetypes in that group, you know, of different people sort of, you know, you had your, you know, let's say you sort of have like your, you know, I don't, and I'm not going to assign labels to people, but I'm going to say that like you had a variety of slots that were filled to the best possible way they could be filled.
Right. Like a good basketball team, like somebody ends up being the scorer, ends up being defense.
And that's the thing is like, there was no moment where if I did a show where I came out for the last 4 minutes in a mono scene and that was it, that's what I did in the show. And maybe I played a dog earlier on. it was still sad. It was as satisfying as if I had been the featured, the focus of the show.
Right.
And so everybody got, everybody just filled, just did what they need to do. Like a, let's, good, a good job.
Let's talk about, so Ruru went on a number of huge cage match runs, yes. At least two mammoth ones and a number of other long ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't part of the, there was three technically because they had their one before they were a team at the theater.
Right, right. Right.
And that was part of the two posts.
So let's talk about the first one that you were a part of. And I want to talk about the mono scene where you and Curtis are riding a plane. Do you remember this one?
The 9/11 scene.
Yeah. Let's talk about that because it's, as I remember.
And wasn't that just you two?
Just you two. You're sitting in seats the whole time, just stationary, riding a plane. And then it's revealed that you're on one of the planes that's going to hit the towers.
Yeah, yeah.
Late in the show.
Very yes. late in the show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And like 9/11.
But
even,
we knew
even
it earlier. We knew. Yeah. I think we both knew probably about 10 minutes in. What was going on.
Really? That soon?
Because I remember he... I can't remember the reference that Curtis made, but he made a reference that was clear to me, oh, this is 9/11. And then I said, oh, Ben Folds' album, new album drops today.
Right.
And that's
all
true
those,
that Ben
Tuesday,
Folds'
right,
album
right.
dropped.
Garbage had an album come out that yeah. day. They Might Be Giants. I remember all these albums were coming out on that
So
day.
That was how we sort of did our secret bird call to each other that we knew what was up. I think we didn't even know. We thought someone else was coming, and then we realized it was just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, all right, I guess we're going to, you know, and we sort of like, we got to win.
And now that would
one.
Be nothing, but I think that there was a while where it's weird when a team first does a show with only one or two people.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
a little yeah. scary to not have all the pieces that you're used to having.
Yeah.
A little
yeah.
bit.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we knew we had to do something. I mean, that's where it's like, just sort of knowing your thing for that moment. Like in that moment, we're like, we're two people, so we know we need to keep it sort of really small, like a real iris in. And this is where we started. This was the first one we did for a long time. We would do them where we just had a sort of slow, a smaller spot wash on the show. I don't know if you remember that, but for a long yeah. time, we just had a spot sort of in the center of the stage, mm-hmm. and then it got foggy on the outside, like it was dark,
yeah.
as opposed to a full wash, I guess
right,
it was
right,
called.
Right.
And that was the first one we did that, where it was just sort of a spot on that area where the chairs were. Mm-hmm. And so I think we just agreed, like, this is going to have to be mostly about characters communicating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then once we figured that out...
And that was going into the show, you had made that decision, like, just give us a spotlight on those two chairs?
I don't think we brought chairs out, but we said, let's do a spot. And that
okay.
will keep us... In
your
a small
cast,
area.
Let's make the stage smaller.
Exactly, small cast, yeah. Went. And, yeah, I mean, Curtis and I, you know, both sort of found that, you know, together and then, you know, realized, like, this is perfect. When the show ends, we've hit the building. And
yeah.
that's like, and I mean, I don't think either of us, and listen, I love 9/11. You know, like
Captain Conspiracy.
I'm yeah. a conspiracy theorist, but also like I think that there is humor to mine from it, and you know, and
9/11 is a
big
comedy killer, obviously.
Yes.
I mean, the hardcore Herald Knight audience, which is the cage match audience, I think is the most tolerant.
Oh, but a weekend
you're gonna find
you
yeah.
really
weekend, or an ass cat, forget it. Yeah,
you can't go near
I've
that
made
stuff.
I was gonna say I made a couple. I only made one, and that was all it took.
I remember
did an ass cat where I made a 9/11 reference.
I remember.
Two silence.
Yeah. I was lucky. I backed up someone else. Tammy Tager
uh-huh.
did a 9/11 reference in an ass cat, and I was, and the audience was like, oh. And whenever the audience is like, oh, come on. Like that, I get really angry because I'm like, you're here at theater. You're here watching something and it wasn't cheap. Like Tammy
yeah.
didn't make a cheap reference to
right,
it.
Right,
it was
uh-huh.
made sense. And so it's sort of that. I mean, there are times, like I remember someone made a Lincoln joke, a Lincoln assassination thing in some scene and people like groaned and I was like, get the fuck
yeah,
over
yeah,
yourselves.
Really, right,
like,
you didn't even know the guy.
But I mean, it's also good because it means that they're responding with more than just laughter.
Yeah.
Because it's better when they're...
Right.
Going through other shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, an awe is often just as good and awesome to get as a laugh, but like a no response kind of groan, like we clearly aggressively disapprove of the move that you're making, is not as good.
Yeah, but I would say that there's an antagonism with the audience that Ruru has.
Yeah.
That was with Cage Match as well as with our weekend. We're kind to our interviewees, but if they're not kind to us, with information or with being like trying to be fucking funny.
Oh yeah, the number one story that I hear from classes when I ask students, "Oh, what shows did you see this weekend?" There's always a story of somebody went to see Ruru and some fucking jerk off only wanted to get on stage because they are funny or an actor and they have no story to tell.
Whenever I do that, I always look at Neil. Neil Casey, the amazing Neil Casey, is my barometer for the bullshit sometimes. I'll look at him and I'll see his, like, oh, come on face. Like, this, like, crumpled come on face. And I'm like, all right, like, here we go. Time to... I mean, and that's the thing is, like, you look at, like, someone like Neil. Like, Neil's, you know, and I work with Neil in Two-Man Movie, is, like, Neil is a making sense machine, right?
Yeah.
Like, he makes sense of all. And then at the same time, and I think that this is the thing, is that working together in that group and doing the cage matches, which gave us our monoscene form, like to make that choice to do it again. I mean, I know other people obviously done it, but like in the Swarm, that was their deal. And like,
but you guys brought
it back. Nobody was really doing it.
Yeah.
And when you guys started doing it,
is that everyone was able to learn how to play like everybody else. So then when, you know, and then everyone who came on, it was like, if we're bringing Pally and Gil on, it's like, we know we wanted them to you had to be more than just a good improviser to be on the team.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be someone that everyone wanted to spend time with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you couldn't spend time with the person, there was that was like the number one rule always, sort of in discussing bringing anybody in, is like, you know, we don't want anything that's going to make it weird because we don't warm up.
Right.
We just sit back there and talk and then go up.
Right.
And like,
which I think is the best
warm-up. Which is the best warm-up, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And like, the idea, if there was some weird vibe or weird, you know, fucking splinter sticking out of the side, it would be just so, it'd be team-crushing, you know? And like, that first run was amazing. I mean, it was an amazing run to do. Because, and I think at a certain point, the audience just knew they could get in with their student cards to see a weekend team.
Right.
I mean, there was definitely times when we should have lost, where we didn't do an incredible show.
Right.
And, you know, someone, you know, we beat them by 9 votes, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I think then the second run was sort of the same thing, but again, you know, really great shows. And then a couple of like, moments where we almost hit the floor and should have gone. And then I forget, and then we got busted in the last one pretty quick. We only went like 3 and out. By Badman.
Badman, yeah.
And you guys lost.
And then we fucking ate it.
Carry the goddamn ball right after.
We dropped that ball.
You're hitting a sore spot with John right now.
I know.
That particular cage match, for some reason.
I'll go to my grave angry about that.
You took out Ruru.
Fucking...
You were the Johnny killer.
Yeah, but then we fucking blew it because we lack anything even remotely resembling consistency.
Oh, come on. That's the self-hatred that a comedian makes. Where's your inner Jimmy Buffett, man?
Yeah. Get your Buffett, man. You're right.
I need a cheeseburger in paradise.
I think that, like, we don't take it seriously, too. That's the other thing is, like, not take it seriously. I don't think anyone's self-important.
I think a good example of you do take it seriously, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Like you have fun. Like when the weekend teams do Herald Night, I remember one time Ruru. I remember thinking, oh, what's Ruru going to do for Herald Night? They can't do a Herald. Like they can't do second beats. They don't have the patience. They're too cool to do a Herald, I thought. But you guys did like a hilarious and great show. You did do good second beats. You did do a good show. And for your opening, you did Hotspot.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
You just sang Hotspot off the suggestion.
Yeah, I
remember that was your opening. It was super, but you were having a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always the discussion before in the hallway when everyone's pitching the openings.
You go.
And like, Neil's always like, we should do a pattern game, do a straight pattern game. And like, let's show these students. You know, Neil's definitely the Boy Scout in that sense of like, let's give these students,
let's honor the form,
let's honor the thing. And then, you know, someone else would be, you know, like, let's do Hotspot. Let's do let's do Knife Throw. You know,
the year after Hotspot, I was sitting backstage and Ruru was discussing what opening to do. This is a Gemberling story. And somebody's like, jokingly was like, at first it was pitching ideas. Let's do documentary. Oh no, let's do scene painting. I like that. And then somebody said, like, let's do scene painting documentary. just kind of throwing it out there. And John got up and said, like, what that would be. Like, he did. Here he goes, and he just kind of, like, made a face. He's like, scene painting documentary. And he's like, we see two chairs.
Yeah, yeah.
There are two actors sitting in two chairs saying bullshit to the audience about whatever suggestion was just said. Forcing their premises.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
That's so true. Yeah, and so then we've had all these great people come on. Mike Still and John Murray and Pally and Liz Kukowski and Gil Ozeri. And I know that Danielle Schneider.
Out West.
Yeah, out West.
Jackie is on it again.
We're a franchised team.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right, yeah. Ruru East, Ruru West. I played with Ruru West.
Oh, you did? Yep. That's great. I've played with Monkey Dick in the reunion shows.
That's right. When we started bringing Anthony in the reunion shows for Monkey Dick. It's like, you should have been here.
I was like, it's a two-man movie. Should I talk about that?
Yeah, please.
Is like the, I just wanted to say with working with Neil and working with Neil from Instant Cinema through, and we were roommates together for a long time, and then through Ruru, we've like sort of carved this path to going back to the movie form because we missed it for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we do this two-man version of it where you can literally want to see our friendship or like our way that we relate, just see the show, because basically I spew lots of like right and left angle, like sort of weird or like illogical moves, and then Neil's just constantly like shaping them, you know. He's like a butterfly catcher, just sort of like, you know, holding the net up. And I would say that like that is a microcosm of everything we do for each other and the whole group, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about your ability to portray and create characters in improv scenes, because I think you're known for it, whether you know it or not, and I think you're pretty great at it. You embody physically, verbally, like you can see the person that you're portraying. Like you make these instant, very strong character choices. What's the process for creating those? What do you see making character choices as?
I think there's two things. The first is to always be aware that even when you're making character choices, over time you will start to slot into sort of like Pat, like you'll slot into our type choices. Like if I'm doing a series of different characters over months, I'll start to go, oh shit, I've done, you know, old fucking Southern guy, or I've done, you know, depressed wife 15 times. I have to be aware of the fact that I'm starting to rely on something I already know. Not that like I'm playing the same character all the time, but like, you know, you fall into slots where you pull in the characters.
Sure.
I mean, I would say like, a lot of times character choices are either what makes sense to the place. Like there's a place. How do I color the place by being a character? So it's either a nondescript area yet, and by coming in and being something that's my interpretation of what type of diner this is or office or whatever, that will help tell my fellow players what I think the place is, and then we build it that way. So a character choice is either a communication tool sometimes, and then I think other times it's a contrast tool. So it's like, now I'm going to set contrast against the space by being this thing. It sounds rudimentary, but a lot of times it's leading with your body. It's how you hold your face.
Let's talk this way. Let's
like sounding
no,
a
no,
teacher.
No, 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 that's great. It sounds great. There's nothing, I love that answer. Yeah. But what do you like have when you step in? Let's say you're on the back line.
Yeah, okay.
Two other people have started a scene. I'll give you a hypothetical. Let's say Curtis and John start, and let's say it's a pretty slow start, and they are two kind of fed up office workers in a break room, and they're kind of disgruntled,
right?
But it's pretty vague. Like, we don't really know. Maybe we don't even know what the company does. But we know that it's like some kind of corporation.
Right.
They got shirts and ties on.
Right.
They're kind of fed up, and they're shooting the shit, having a cup of coffee.
Yep.
Let's say that's all you got.
My example's going to be terrible. Go.
So I'm just regardless of how awesome the decision is, like, what do you have when you walk in?
Oh,
like how much do you have when you step in?
I think when you're sitting there, you I think that I mean, you want to know the real process. In my mind's eye, I see a character. So okay. In my mind's eye, I see someone.
Okay.
Right? So then I'll go...
Do you want a better starting point, or can you use that hypothetically?
No, I mean, maybe I'll see, like, sort of, you know, maybe I'll see sort of like a jittery, aw, shucks, sort of like sad sack guy who's got like a brown suit on and like an off-kilter tie and is just trying to sneak into the break room to get a cup of coffee,
right?
You know, and is intimidated by those two guys.
Okay.
Right.
Or I might...
So that's enough to walk in.
That's enough to walk in. Or I might just go, I want to be a window washer. And I don't know what I'm going to be yet, but I'm going to raise my... I'm going to do this action and be a window washer on the outside. And then...
If you do that choice, you're going to be a window washer. I mean, yeah. So what's your physicality going to be?
Swaying first, because you're on a swaying grade.
Just the reality of being a window washer. And then, like, what kind of dude are you? Are you like a laissez-faire dude that's...
I don't know any of that yet.
Okay. Are you happy, up, or do you know what your emotional place is?
I'm probably... You know, with people... Characters like that, it's... You're probably neutral up in the get-go. Neutral to in some state of pleasant.
Right. I mean, open.
Because if you come in, unless there's something that would, being aggressive in some way would work to serve and help
like
them.
Like something's already going on.
It's right, not right. going to help for me to be just an aggressive, closed-off piece of shit who's washing windows.
Let me give you a new hypothetical. You tell me what you walk in as.
Oh, God,
you hate these.
No, it's fun. Yeah. It's fun.
Let's say everyone at Ruru is in. You haven't entered yet. They're safe-cracking.
Right.
It's a heist gone wrong.
Right.
Like, they're trying to, like, weld open the safe, but, like, they don't... The tool isn't working. Everything has gone perfectly to this moment, but now they can't get into the final vault.
Right.
And they're like an Ocean's 11 sort of like crack team.
I would be somebody in the vault, like an old woman locked in there. That's what I would do.
All right, if you're going to do that, what are you thinking about when you decide that? Like, what's in your mind's eye of that?
I mean, what happened right now was, like, if all these people are trying to break into this vault and there's this last vault, then probably it's been a lot of, like, we got to get in this vault and, like, So, like, it would... Then I'm going, well, what's in there that they want? And, you know, whatever they want isn't really important.
Right.
So maybe someone being in there. My bad move would be that I appear as one of them from the future. Some sort of time machine. And ruin the scene.
Well, sounds like with the window washer example, like,
I don't know what I think.
But what it is just getting a little glimpse of the thought process. Like, there's a choice of, like, I just want to do this thing. Yeah. And I'm going to go out there, I'm going to make this choice, and then I'm going to figure it out from there. Or making that decision of, like, okay, here's something that the scene might need.
And I think here's the thing with what you're how you're describing, is that each thing is like... a game of Go. You ever play Go?
Yeah.
A Harold scene, I mean, a scene sort of like Go.
Mm-hmm.
It's like these sort of defensive, offensive moves and sort of thing. You know, you're trying to think a bunch of steps ahead, maybe to sort of, not ahead, but like to see where you're going with it.
Yeah.
And so in that scenario, there would probably be 7 or 8 details.
Right, that
would
make a big
difference.
That
then make you go, okay, maybe I should be this thing. I mean, sometimes I just fucking off, and I just come in to be something that's, you know, a variable in the equation, and see how everyone plugs their things in. Because there's something good about a character that everyone can plug their shit into. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
They can all either find their way to attack it, or to judge it, or to... support it, or to want to
lots of ways for them to connect its status. With
mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to be a carbon atom. The best characters are carbon based, not just
as opposed to something
forms.
That's isolated. There's no way to get to them.
Yes, mm-hmm. And sometimes isolated characters, I think a lot like those elements, disappear very quickly. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that true that, like, the more unstable, the more unstable the element at the end of the chart, the less time it exists, right? I mean, a lot of those experimental ones exist for, like, nanoseconds.
Right.
So, like, sometimes if you're doing, like, a really, really just a one-point, one-off character, then, you know, then you need to know to go. It's not just about the choice. It's about where, how long you're out on stage, what you're doing.
Yeah, what size role are you for this story.
And know to get fucking out. Like, that's the thing, is to always know you can always come back. So if you don't need to be there, go. And if you need to be there, do something.
Mm-hmm.
Valuable, you know, that helps you know, that helps the whole. Because that's all that's important. I mean, it's very communistic, but, like, it's true. But the individual doesn't really matter as much as the whole.
Absolutely. In improv, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah.
It's where you are plugging into and what you're adding to.
Yeah. And I like old people. I like old people throwing my tongue around.
Yeah.
I like playing different types of women. I think my favorite is when I grab onto the idea of sort of the, like, the butchy woman in her, like, 50s who's, like, married to her husband. And I don't often get that right, but when I do, like, nail that sweet spot of not just being, like, so many women are just like, hi, I'm a woman, like, that sort of thing.
Right.
But, like, that sort of, like, almost genderless woman is, like, my favorite character. The, like, zippy go-getter woman and the, like, the waist that has, like, a rubber band in it.
Yeah.
But even that is, like, the way that you're talking about it and the way that you're able to think about it is very specific and descriptive. And I think that's the key. Like, do you observe people a lot consciously? Do you...
Yeah, I watch. I love... I watch people. I use people from my life.
Mm-hmm.
I use people who I was fascinated with, and then they're just stored in my brain. And that's why talking before a show's so good. Because you run down things that happen in your life and they trigger things that stay in the soup in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And like, also like you, it's like, you can't think, I mean, it's hard to, it's like almost like describing thinking. Like you don't, you don't verbally, verbiage is the thing that's got to get knocked out.
Right.
You know, for me, I play very, I'm lucky to have worked with everyone else. Cause like I can sometimes grab Neil Casey's mind a little bit and play that way.
Right.
And feel good because I didn't have that.
And what do you mean when you say that? Like, what does that mean to you?
It means...
do you mean, like, more analytically or sort of, like, bird's eye? Because the way you've described him so far is, like, kind of, like, fixing stuff that... Or not, whatever, like, justifying...
Oh, and I don't want to say... You know, this actually ties back into that, which is that the thing that's amazing about Neil is that Neil could do that, and then Neil does amazing, committed...
Yeah, I feel like Neil, in the last couple of years, has been a guy who, like... is almost like the safety. It's like, what's missing? I'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do we need a big straight man just to let everyone else react to? Or do we need the big comic center or whatever?
Yeah.
I feel like he's pretty pretty amazingly adaptable.
Oh, yeah. He's, he's
I mean, totally every good player is, and everyone on Ruru is, but I feel like Neil in particular the last couple of years has shown in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
When I hear other improvisers talking about him.
I mean...
So what aspect of him are you thinking of?
When
you say, I can sometimes grab Neil and play, how is that different than what you might do?
I think that there's a little more attention to detail of game and how game serves other things in the scene. It's almost like, being a little bit more on top of yourself, more lined up. Mm-hmm. Like if I could do a show where I play a little bit like Curtis, a little bit like John, a little bit like Neil, a little bit like Gelman, a little bit like every other person and Jackie and still, if I could do that, then I'm in a great spot because, and me obviously.
Right.
But having that ability, like playing with John, like John is like, John is amazing to play with because he's such a force in so many ways.
Yeah.
And he's so able, he's amazingly able to make one stroke moves. If you want to talk about character, like I have to have like sometimes like multiple strokes to shape it. Mm-hmm. John can come in and with one line,
yeah,
just one line. I'm doing a paintbrush thing.
Right.
John, you could thank me later. one line, he's just shaped into that person. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's amazing. It's amazing to watch. John's, like, a fabulous actor. And and that's the thing, too, is, like, if you know, you have actors also doing... Because, you know, I was listening to the Ian Roberts podcast. It's so true that it is writing on your feet. I mean, that's what it is. That's the... A lot of it is serving and writing, you know, making things make sense, and acting is important. But boy, to have both, to have the ability to act and sort of create something, you know, that makes sense is like an amazing thing. So I think what I take from Neil, I don't know how much time we've been going.
We've got an hour.
I actually have to go.
Oh.
So you guys can continue, but okay. I want to hear the rest of your point, I have to run out.
I think that, yeah, playing like Neil is definitely playing with more analysis, more, like, attention to the whole of it. Like, I tend to be someone who's in the parts, and Neil can see the whole, I think, more a lot of times.
I see that.
So that's what I was saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Okay, you're gonna.
I have to jump out of here.
All right, we'll go ahead and do it.
So, but thanks.
Bye, John.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, John. See ya.
See you later.
Yeah, see ya. I gotta go.
I don't know. I've never closed the show without you.
Well,
I don't know what to do.
You'll be great. Just say goodbye.
All right.
Okay. I'll remind you.
I'm leaving all this in.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna edit this.
No, you should not edit this out. I gotta find my way out of this electrical closet.
It's pretty easy.
That door's right there.
Oh, is that
no,
already?
John? What are you doing? You're walking into the cooler.
Oh,
John,
no, this is where
don't
I'm
go
at.
In there.
Don't go in the cooler.
No, cool.
Oh boy. All
right, see you.
Okay, bye. That was a great bit. Going in the cooler. Lots of fun.
Let's talk about this. What's so? You teach classes here. You're a popular teacher. What do you talk about when you give me like the. What are the craziest subjects you find yourself getting on a lot?
Teaching-wise or like things I bring up in class?
Things you bring up. Like I feel – I'll tell you exactly what I'm talking about.
Because
I read
all the comments.
I read the evaluations from the students and a lot of times they'll be like, I really like Anthony's Jungian theories on improv. Or it's like, oh, he's really like a wizard, you know, how much he sees in the philosophy that informs – the magic of improv. It sounds like kind of like mystical
that
stuff.
That person sounds like an asshole.
Yeah, and that person's probably like a kiss ass. But it always makes me wonder. It's like, well, I wonder what the fuck was Anthony talking about that inspired this?
Well, first off, you remember, I mean, you were only in 85 for about 3 months before you went to Stepfathers.
That's not true. No,
oh, you were in longer?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Sanders
like
left early.
Oh, Sanders was the
Sanders
first
left
one.
Early. Because you're talking about, because my old Herald team mentioned 85, you coached us forever.
Which was, for me, as a teacher, that was a transcendent thing for me in working with you guys for that time because it was collaborative.
Sort of like veteran people. Yeah, yeah.
Everyone was veteran. It was very collaborative. And I did a lot of that weird shit.
Yeah, that's true.
And with you guys.
Yeah.
Which I wish sometimes I could do more, like coming in and coaching half the group, half of one rehearsal as Poppy.
Yeah, right.
As a character.
Anthony once came in and pretended to be a short form master, British guy named Poppy. Was your name Poppy?
No, my name was St. John, St. Clair, St. John.
Right. You just wanted us to be more Poppy.
Yeah, I wanted you to be more Poppy. Every time you
our
did a scene,
wasn't Poppy
make it poppier, make it poppier. That's what I would do. I would just yell.
He came in as a bit telling us to do short form games, but then, yeah, we did spend at least half the rehearsal just short form.
Did I show you were in it when I showed the team a picture of my shit? Right.
I feel like I do remember.
I took a shit that looked like a question mark. I came back in from the break and I was like, everyone's got to look at this. It really was. why?
Well, I don't know. Like, I'd be curious to know at your like most inspired moments. What do you like to? I wish I could just. I'm not a good enough interviewer to do this.
Okay.
But I wish I could just like.
Maybe I'm not a good enough interviewee.
Maybe. Okay. I don't think that's it. But like, what's at your improv nerdiest?
Yeah.
You're like in a teacher role.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you find yourself like talking about? Like when you know.
Well, some of the things we're talking about here, but like first off, I mean, as far as the Jungian stuff goes, I'm in Jungian therapy.
Okay.
And so I have a cursory knowledge of it in the sense that I think I've read 3 books by Jung, and I've been in therapy with him, and I mean not with him, but with him. I'm a time traveler. And I've read Man and His Symbols and Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, and I own the Red Book and a bunch of stuff like that. Try to talk about – I have the students read it because I found that when I read Man and His Symbols, I could just understand its application in improvisation in the sense of calling upon archetypes of characters, archetypes of different representations of oneself. And so if we talk about character in that sense that all things exist within ourself.
Right.
And I bring it up also because in level one and even 1 through 3, everyone's working to get out of their own way. So everybody shows up and
you're
says,
self-conscious,
yeah.
You're worried about being...
And by being self-conscious, you show up and you drop you. And I do, when I do stand-up now, the first thing I do is I go up on stage and go, oh, well, I better get rid of me.
Right.
And now this empty shell will have information to dispense to the audience. And then you stand there panicking going, why did I drop myself at the door? Right. And so I find that that helps to make them understand mentally this process, as fun as it will also be a revealing process. It can't not be a revealing process. I don't care how much it's just about game or just about, you know, the skills of improv. If you're really pursuing it, it will reveal you, because your brush is your brain, is your consciousness.
Yeah.
And your relationship to your unconsciousness, because all people do is self-betray when they're in front of other people, right?
Right.
So when you sit and watch scenes, I get all like sort of worked up when you have like the scenes where, you know, someone comes in and the things are like, well, I don't like being here. I don't like you.
Right.
I don't like this idea. You took, you know, you stole this from me or whatever. Always actually apply usually to two human beings going, I don't like you. I'm uncomfortable with you. I don't like your choice of location. You stole my Joker idea.
Right.
Right. And so if we just put the cards on the table and say, we're all going to do this. And if we take because the thing I remember going up in classes was the fear of, is everyone else better and funnier than I am?
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Is everyone else better than me? Does everyone else get it? So I just tell everyone right away, none of you fucking get it.
Okay.
You don't get it. Even if you get it, you don't get it. Because I got it a little bit and I didn't know it.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the things I get worked up in are like teaching people, trying to tell people to see without verbiage, without words.
Okay.
And to try to understand that the reorganization of the brain is that when you, as opposed to perceiving a scene as, I have to walk in and I have to remember to be this character. I have to walk in and remember where the sofa is and what's going on and what was the unusual thing and what was this detail.
Right.
I don't walk into this room and say, I have to remember that the door is here. I have to remember you're sitting here. I have to remember what we're talking about and what my name is.
Right.
That would be insane. There's a part of our brain that does that automatically. Right. And it just is running. It's just a big, you know, huge, it's like the Whopper computer in
War Games.
Yeah. It's just running. And the idea is that the conscious mind is working in a fear capacity because it's doing something new. And it doesn't understand why, in my view, this is my philosophy, it doesn't understand why there's a part of your brain saying, I'm in a living room, but it clearly sees that you're in a classroom.
Right.
And we underestimate that. We underestimate the resistance of the survival instinct of the brain to make sense of what's going on. So that same skill is very helpful in improv, but you have to do an end around. So you have to find the way to plug in the part of you that can automatically assess things and park them.
Right.
And not be walking into a scene going, oh, where's the sofa again? Because if you're thinking about that shit, you're not in the scene.
Right.
Right? You're standing in front of a bunch of people. Right. If you're thinking, I better be good and I better be funny and, you know, I'm going to refer to something that Anthony mentioned in the notes.
Yeah.
Then you're not there.
Right.
You're on a trip about what you're doing and who you are, and that's not what this is about.
Right.
You know? That's what I think. Now, does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay.
It does sound like what I would imagine you talking about.
Yeah. And I talk a lot about sex.
Do you?
Yeah.
In what context?
I talk about how how playing the game, resting the game in 301. I'll talk about resting the game, and I'll be like, it's just like good sex. Nobody wants to go out and get a great idea and come 15 times in one day. You'd be tired. So a good scene is that you're working it a little bit, you move away, you work the thigh, you come back.
Jesus.
Yeah, you'll get lawsuits on that. But, like, I do, because it's a good metaphor. It's one, you know what, I like those things, too. I mean, I shouldn't be, I guess, giving away my tricks, but like, it's good because that's something everyone can relate to, and it puts everybody off kilter a little bit.
Yeah.
It makes everybody get a little like, you know, everyone goes, oh, you know.
Yeah.
And so therefore, whenever you get people off their set notion of what it is, they're more open to receive information.
I believe it.
I don't know.
How do you reconcile this part of your brain that's like, you know, kind of like serious and philosophy and trippy with the part of your brain that is like super obnoxious, humor wise, like that loves like kind of like saying the obnoxious thing and gets like fed up. It's like, oh, this person with this thing. Like, I feel like a big part of like what makes you so much fun on stage is like right away your characters can just have an immediate, fully formed opinion on anything that's brought up.
Yeah.
And it's just ready to like be very passionate, not negative necessarily, but like, I don't know, like
sometimes negative, sometimes aggressive, negative, maybe
aggressive, or yeah, assertive. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's like a big part of you, I think.
Yeah,
and all of Ruru, like yeah. hanging out before a show, is kind of like I feel like the group energy of Ruru is like, oh, give me a break.
Yeah,
this is full of shit. Yeah. I feel like,
well, because the whole world's, I mean, it's all full of
so
shit.
How do you reconcile that dude
with this?
This hippie, like, mysticism.
Well, because we're all binary. Because all things, because everything is hip, and all things are Hippocratic. Hypocritical.
Yeah.
And Hippocratic. I mean, you know, there's this idea of ourselves as being, there's two things. One is the idea that we're as in control of our motivations as we think, which we're often not. We're right. not aligned up, we're not lined up with ourselves, and most of the things that are coming out are already conceived. You know, and mm-hmm. ordered by another dark passenger who you don't have a relationship with, right?
Right, right.
Which is your other self that's in you. And the other thing is that you have that part of you that is animalistic and visceral.
Right.
And if you can line those two things up, it's fine to vacillate between the two. Both things coexist in me.
Yeah.
And I'm never the same person. I'm not the same person sitting here that I will be in 10 minutes.
Right,
your
right,
consciousness
right.
doesn't work like that. The yeah. idea of a linear self is so is not, it doesn't sit with me.
Right, right.
So that binary makes sense. And of course there are times when I do stuff and I'm like, oh man, I'm breaking everything that I actually would hate if I saw this. I would think it's so hack. And I get that punishment too sometimes on stage. I'll go for one extra step too far,
yeah.
or I'll grab at a pun because, you know, John loves to make puns, and for yeah. some reason everybody loves when John makes them and everyone hates when I make them. And there's been a scene where John makes a pun and then I do one, and he's like, and even John will be like, come on. And I'm like, what the fuck? You know, but like, I think the other thing is like all that resides in me and in you. Like, you know, listen, the killer resides in me. The comforter resides in me. The arrogant prick, the sheepish woman, the you know, the sexy husband, or I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
All those things live in you. So why not let them play out through you?
Right.
You know, the honesty is that some of the fucked up stuff I say, I have felt or believed right. in my life. That's important, I think, to not divorce from yourself and go, you know, I can draw up the passion to choke John Murray in a
right,
scene.
Right, right.
There's a part of me in that moment that is really, truly wanting to be murderous.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that wants that.
Yeah.
If I don't let that come a little bit, then it's sort of like hacky and
right.
lame.
Right, right.
If you're going to go, you might as well go
right.
the whole way. Because there's no reason to just go and step out a little bit on and play it set third person from yourself. That makes no sense.
I agree. I think I have to wrap it up here.
Oh, that's good.
I'm just deciding that now.
Yeah.
I
talk a lot.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love all. I like you when you're in this mode. That's why I wanted you to do it. I love hearing you talk about those things that way. And I think that's what makes you really good. I think all of Ruru and all the sort of top improvisers at any theater are interesting in that way, like have that side to them, have like a deeper side than you might assume if you just watch a couple of scenes.
Yeah,
with them.
Yeah, and Curtis too, I should say, is
yeah.
a big Jungian guy. And
right, he's the other, yeah, that's true.
We're sort of young buddies, and
yes,
you know.
I've either heard him talk about it or I've heard other yeah. people mention that he's brought it up and stuff.
And I learned a lot of that from him. You know, I mean, working with him.
Yeah.
How he brings, you know, he brings, and him and Gelman both bring that, bring a bravado. They're sort of like that balance too for each other, I think.
Really?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I mean, I think that like
they bring out a side of each other that I don't always see when they're around other people. I guess.
Yeah.
Or I don't know. We've known them so long. It's weird. It depends like what year you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
them and most people I know have gone through like crazier periods and then more like together periods.
And that visceral, I would say, I got from working with Brett. Brett taught me an immense amount about like not fucking. I mean, for all the ways that you know. You know, Gelman can have his own
yeah.
stuff. Like, you know, that willingness to just, I just remember Romano, I know we have to wrap, I remember Romano scene where, like, we had this diner scene, and it was a cage match. It was okay. It was a diner. And Gelman was, I think, a dishwasher. He came in for a job or something. He got really pissed. He's like, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to fucking kill all of you.
That's how it ended, right?
And he left. And this long stretch goes by. Gelman doesn't come on, and we're doing this scene. And then he just kicks the door open. He's got a shotgun, and he's just blowing everyone away. Right. And everyone's shrieking and screaming. And, like,
I remember that.
That, to me, is Ruru. Ruru is a shotgun in a diner.
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast and talking.
Thank you, Will.
I know it it feels a little weird to just kind of come in here and rehearse and dump all that, but it's interesting. I'm glad you did it.
Well, thank you.
And
great hosting.
Thanks so much.
You guys do a great job. So I love the podcast. Everyone should listen and send it to 20 other people.
Good. Do it. Yeah. Pass it on.
Yeah.
Thanks for putting up their electrical closet here.
I'm going to get high in here now. Okay. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking.
Just for old time's sake.
Yeah, for old time's sake.
All right, everybody. We'll come back next week for another episode of this podcast. John will know what number it is then, and he will assure all the OCD members of this audience. I don't know who our guest is going to be, but we're on track now. We're starting to do this once a week again, so I think we should be able to continue. Thanks to our guest, Anthony Tamanik.
Thank you again, Will.
And we'll see you guys all back here soon. Bye.